There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I came across One Year No Beer, and I loved it because it was the first time it was a positive message around not drinking, you know, as a lifestyle choice that was legitimate, that didn't mean that your life had fallen apart.
Welcome to Series 2 of the 1 Year No Beer Podcast.
If you haven't hit subscribe yet, then hit that button so you don't miss another episode.
Welcome to another fantastic episode of the 1 Year No Beer Podcast. Today, I am joined by a very special lady, Sam White, who is known as a business mogul. I have to find out what this word mogul means.
So do I, mate.
Business mogul. Are you around, like, eating businesses? set up your first business at 24. And been very successful in business in the insurance industry. And the reason why we've brought you on today, apart from you being an amazing human being and putting out amazing things in the world, so you know, your LinkedIn and everything you talk about and what you represent is amazing things. But you've also changed your relationship with alcohol, and I think you did it with 1 Year No Beer.
I did indeed. Yes. Yes.
Good. So, Sam, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on. I love this. This is a great way to start the day. Can you come around to my house and fill me with all of this positivity first thing in the morning?
Every day.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that would be great.
I could do it via WhatsApp.
That would be amazing.
Sam, you're amazing. Right.
I keep asking the wife to do it, but for some reason she's not so keen.
That reminds me about something I say a lot is your greatest piece of real estate in your house is your mirror. Right, because you're there every single day and you brush your teeth every single day, right?
Yes.
So this is the spot you've got a few minutes to stare at. Like, that is where you put the vision, that is where you put the notification, the vision board, that is where you put the mantras and the things like that. So maybe I can send you a little picture of me with, like, you're amazing.
And again, I think the wife may take it down, but I will give it a good go.
Fantastic. So tell us a bit of background, Sam, a bit of background into your history. Tell us about
Sure.
Sam.
I mean, that's a long one. I'm pretty old, so.
You don't look old.
Well, that's the lack of drinking, clearly. So grew up in the north of England, in a place called Cheadle in Stockport.
Yep.
Child of a dysfunctional alcoholic, which you would think would make me go running for the hills and not go anywhere near alcohol. But it's a strange relationship that we have in our society. Mm. And, you know, I've reflected on it quite a few times because I look at it, if alcohol was a person, so it's a person that had kind of stolen your childhood and killed your mum. You never would invite that person around your house.
Ever.
You'd be like, they are not coming to dinner.
Yeah. Who abused you every weekend, right? Made you feel horrific.
Yeah.
Constantly depressing you and making you tired and sleepless.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You'd be like, oh, hey, do you want to come around again?
Yeah. Come around. I know that we had a bit of a shit time last weekend, but why don't you
come
again?
Let's try again.
Let's go again.
I love the way you've put that. It's so good.
So, grew up in that situation. My mum actually overdosed when I was 23.
Ooh,
and that was, you know, as might be expected, was a difficult period of time. I also kind of exhibited a number of characteristics, which I now know is quite common from children of alcoholics. So at 24, I was 5 stone overweight. I smoked 55 bags a day. I ate nothing but junk food. I had never seen the inside of a gym. And I also drank, not to a dysfunctional level, but I would, you know, go out at the weekends and get pretty much the same as most 20-year-olds, I guess.
Normal in Yorkshire.
What would be considered to be normal drinking, but actually, if you look at the medical guidelines, it would be absolutely horrific.
Yeah, so, yeah.
And I actually, on one of my nights out, I ended up bringing some mates back to the house, a couple of lads that I was friends with. We decided that a water fight would be really a great idea, and I ended up breaking my leg, dislocating my ankle and breaking my leg. So within a very short space of time, I broke my leg, split up with my boyfriend at the time because I realised whilst nursing the broken leg that the relationship wasn't really working. And then my mum died. And all of those things kind of in one lump really made me reflect on what I wanted out of life, whether I was on the right path, you know, what I should be doing. And I ended up setting up my first company when I was 24 from my sister's conservatory.
Cool. Trying to get that jump there from these things. And then, you know, I'm going to go in. So you channeled the energy, or you realized, because there's, you know, we've had a part discussion here about mental health, which we're going to get onto, and sort of thinking differently. Is this,
Yes. Mind
you were thinking differently back then?
I was, but not really with any order or process. Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of, and I think it is the entrepreneurial mindset. And, you know, we spoke before we started about the fact that I was dyslexic as a kid, and that kind of has certain characteristics to it. I think I've always been reflective, and I think that's probably my strongest characteristic. So whenever I've done stuff, I haven't been oblivious to it, and I've not been somebody who justified my own behaviour.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was really fat, I knew it was my fault.
Mm.
I knew it was because I ate too much. I never said, oh, I've got really slow metabolism. In fact, I had my metabolism tested just to be sure, and it definitely wasn't slow. It was all of the McDonald's that I was eating and the lack of exercise that I was doing. So I've always kind of owned that.
Okay.
But it's been a little bit of a windy road, and I think this is true of most people. So now at the grand old age of 47, I can look back and I can make sense of some of the things that I did and where that put me. But the best way I like to visualize it now is that your brain is the house that you live in. And your current sort of neural pathways that you have and all the habits that you have that form those neural pathways is your current home. I think what I was doing for a number of years was building my dream home alongside that current home.
Mm-hmm.
And that may sound like a strange thing, but bear with me.
Yep.
Things like exercise took me a few years to really lock in.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things that I say to people when I'm talking to them and they're finding things hard right now, or they think that it'll never happen just because they had a period of abstinence or a period of being healthy and then they fell off. I don't look at it that way. I look at it that I was building foundations in my new house. So the first time I ever did any exercise of any sort whatsoever, I'd set up the company. It was going pretty well. I'd been going 2 or 3 years, and I'd built up a decent enough revenue and a small team of around 10 people. And I was still struggling with my weight, and I also was struggling with panic attacks at the time. So I decided to go traveling around the world. I took a year off, stayed in touch with the team. I was just like, I'm off.
Nice.
And I went and, you know, did Thailand and Fiji and Australia and South America and all these places. But I made it my mission during that year to tackle my weight and to tackle some of my health issues. And I consider that to be, you know, almost like the first wall built. Mm. Now, when I got
first rung of the ladder,
the ladder, and I lost a load of weight while I was traveling, came back, and after that, I'd fall off a bit, and my weight would go up a bit, But I maintained a reasonably regular exercise routine, which stayed with me.
Yeah, so the habit was locked in.
The habit was locked in. And, you know, I've seen this when I look back over my life and go, okay, at this point, and some are definite. So when I gave up smoking when I was 30, that was a literally overnight. I had been smoking 50 cigarettes a day. I smoked from 20 to 30 and then... Or like a couple of weeks after my 30th birthday, I said, I'm not doing this anymore. And I just stopped. Mm. And that was actually really easy in comparison to a lot of other things, because there is literally zero positive impact from smoking that you can give to your brain in any way, shape or form if you properly step back from it. And before that point, I was almost smoking out of belligerence. It was like,
I'm going to hold on to this.
I'm holding on to this bad habit because nobody wants me to do it. So I'm going to do it. I'm going to carry on smoking.
I think a few people will resonate with that.
Yeah. And also, you know, I justified, well, I like it, I enjoy it, but I didn't. Like, and as soon as I gave it up, I felt much better. And so it was dead easy not to go back. Mm. And of course, nobody really pressurizes you to start smoking again. Whereas when with alcohol, I've loads of times over the years, I'd have like a break for 3 months or like I kind of played around with my alcohol consumption quite a lot.
Yeah.
What was harder with that as a habit to break was the massive amount of societal pressure on the other side, and also how much it was woven into both my social interactions, but also my work interactions. And that really took more planning. So I kind of go, more building was needed, and, you know, maybe more architects to come in and, you know, more consultation on that wing of the house from a brain viewpoint.
Yeah, I like that. And I guess bringing in the architects, bringing in a bit of expertise helps you do it. So and then what happens? Do you slowly migrate over into the new house?
So
do you suddenly move all in one day?
No.
I've got all my habits nailed.
I think what happens is you live there for a few weeks and then you move back into the old house.
I like that.
And this goes on.
Yeah.
And what I'm feeling right now for the first time in my life is that maybe I'm going to take permanent residence in the new home. And it feels...
Time to move in.
Time to move in. It feels amazing in a way that I haven't had before.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's... We talked briefly before, challenges in business. You know, I've a couple of times I've nearly lost the companies. You know, the businesses have got now, both in the UK and Australia, you know, 250 staff and turnover 20 odd million. And, you know, they're doing great. But over that full 23 years, I have nearly lost all of the businesses twice. And, you know, you have those moments where you're like, oh, Jesus. Like,
when you talk to a founder and you say those words, they understand the depth of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, I nearly lost the business. I don't think many people grasp what that actually feels like. Because if I play that back to you, my own experience of nearly losing the business is that both my wife and I's salary come from there.
Yep.
You know, the place we live, the school the kids go to, all of our choices, everything about our life is about to die.
Yes.
It's not just, oh, well, this business will go down. It's like, oh, no, I've put 8 years into this. I've put all of our savings into it. I went all in on this.
Yeah.
And it's just about to go.
Yeah.
That is fucked for your mental health. Oh, sorry.
It is brutalizing. And the first time it happened, I'd come off a really big high. So, you know, the business started in 1999, and by 2010, it was turning over 18 million. I was making sort of 3-4 million profit. And I decided I was going to go and live in Beverly Hills, which is a whole different story. Had Robbie Williams sing at my wedding and had this like mad adventure. So I had a lot of swagger on at that point. Mm. I was like, I've got this nailed. I thought I was moving into the house. Actually, I didn't think I was moving into the house because I hadn't tackled the stuff that was my stuff. Yep. So to be fair, I was aware I had a way to go, but I definitely had a bit of a swagger on. And then all hell broke loose. There was a load of changes in the market that I was in at the time, which wasn't specifically insurance. It was handling claims on behalf of insurance companies. And we lost 60% of our revenue in a 4-week period. And, you know, I had I didn't have any backing because I'd never had any funding. I'd just grown it organically.
Amazing.
So there was nobody else. It was all bootstrapped. But of course, the negativity of that is you can burn through your cash in a very short space of time. And I hadn't exactly been frugal living in Beverly Hills.
So traveling a lot.
Traveling a lot. And, yeah, exactly. And doing all of that.
You got your own Concord.
Yeah. So, you know, it was a real kind of kick in the teeth. And to your point, at that point, my entire family, not just my family, like me, my wife, my kids, but my extended family, my dad, my sister, all of her kids, like, and the people that worked in the business, like, I had close friends and people that had been with me for absolutely years. And they all want you to have the solutions. And that's the gig. That's, you know, that's the joke about that's why they pay me the big bucks. And some, unfortunately, at certain times, that also isn't true.
Yeah, exactly. It's not.
But you know, at that point, I had a great life from the business and just had to kind of knuckle down and work through it.
Mm.
But you know, I think alcohol does play a part in that because there is also a story that you tell yourself that this is all really hard. I deserve a release.
Yeah, exactly.
I deserve to be able to switch my brain off and relax. And I have that conversation a lot with people who are like high pressure, high performers.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, they see this as this gift that they're giving themselves. Which is ironic when I look at it now because it's like the worst possible gift you could ever give yourself.
No,
you know?
It's the worst. Yeah.
Yeah. But I do think that it kind of plays a part in that.
Yeah. It's a gift in the moment, unfortunately. It's just so taking thereafter, which, you know, and we all know. Talking a bit about the business side of it, you know, there is that. First of all, do you think that these things like dyslexia and, you know, you talked a bit before about perhaps being undiagnosed ADHD and having a very overreactive brain, you know, those things are absolutely a source of numbing and compulsive behavior. Mm-hmm. So we know they're intrinsically linked to compulsive behavior. And so far more likely to be using drugs or alcohol or things like that. But also, I've mentioned this on a podcast before. I went to a seminar. I must get the detail of this because it's a bit fluffy. But at this seminar, this person got up to speak and they started to reel out some symptoms. Okay, so symptom one, you know, distracted all day. Symptom two, and it was like symptoms of a CEO. or a founder. And they read through all these things. And every time they came up, they said, stand up in the room if this applies to you. Now, by the time they'd gone through all the symptoms, everyone in the room was standing up saying, yep, that's me. And then they peeled off the top bit and it said, this is actually the diagnosis for bipolar disorder.
Yeah.
Right. So this mental health thing, very linked to that kind of different thinking and then the creation of business. So long-winded question, but do you see that as a source of your business creation, this, and that you had to tame it? Or how do you think it impacted your
the dyslexia drive?
Yes.
Yeah. I do think dyslexia is a superpower. And like whenever I'm talking to parents and they're like, oh, my child's been diagnosed dyslexic, I'm like, amazing. like 60, 70% of entrepreneurs are dyslexic. We do think differently.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I'm also...
60 to 70% of entrepreneurs are dyslexic.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And so, you know, when you...
Before, just going in onto that. I don't think they're... made to feel that way as kids.
No,
you made
not.
To feel that way?
No, absolutely not. I was made to feel stupid.
Yeah, stupid. Yeah, an outcast.
Yeah.
And wrong.
Yeah, yeah. And
probably when you were growing up, hit over the head or
yes,
something.
Yes, absolutely.
Time, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just focus more. Or,
yeah. Yeah. And I had the type of dyslexia that makes you write everything backwards. So at one point, the teacher, so if you held my work up to a mirror, you could read it.
Wow.
And the teacher, yeah, I can't remember what it's called. It's a
the teacher thought you were being deliberate.
Did she thought I was being, I was like, how smart did you think I was, for fuck's sake? Like, we can barely learn how to write and I'm writing backwards. Yeah, it was a challenge. Actually, to be fair, my mum at that point, who'd also been dyslexic as a child,
right.
Really did me an absolute solid, and she went in and kicked off, and they gave me the proper help, and I came out of that, and I went from bottom group and everything to top group and everything because I could actually read the instructions, which was fantastic. And I, you know, I read voraciously now, but I am conscious of the fact that how I assess risk is very different to other people, which again is a construct of dyslexia. But then you look at the entrepreneurial mindset, of course, like normal people.
Risk tolerance.
Yeah, through the roof. And it has to be because, you know, otherwise you wouldn't get things started.
Yes.
So is it, you know, does it help? Absolutely. Does it have to be very consciously managed? Yes.
Oh, yeah. That is something you've just struck a little lightning on in my brain. I need to go and research and understand deeper. Risk tolerance and risky behavior, that must be very...
It's in that part of the brain.
Exactly.
It's in the bit of the brain that ADHD and
dyslexia. So the understanding of risk, your concept of risk, your ability to deal with risk and all of that stuff. Yeah, totally. You know, you started a business at a young age, 24, but it was immediately successful. I started multiple businesses by the time I was 25. None of them were successful. So I was a serial failpreneur. So what do you think made that your success in the early days?
Some of it was necessity. So okay. I don't know if you had any funding to start up a business or
well, I
not.
Did. I had a bit of dad.
Yeah, because there was no safety net for me. Yeah. I'd also, me and my sister both sold our houses, bought a house together. She had four kids, and the mortgage was being paid with the proceeds from the business. So there was like
no option.
There was no option. And so people talk a lot in business about focus. And actually, I have a bit of a bugbear because women struggle to get funding. It's a lot harder as a female entrepreneur to get funding than men. And it's an area that I'm really fascinated in terms of how we communicate.
Mm-hmm.
My general experience is, you know, men probably do exhibit more focus because women tend to be more big picture. They tend to think about more variables at once. And there's lots of biological reasons for that in terms of, you know, having to manage a larger area of scope of risk and also the social interactions that women had to form from a collaboration viewpoint versus kind of male biology thousands and thousands of years ago. But I think it does play out in investment in the... When you're going for an investor story, they want it really, really simple. I am going to sell bananas and I'm going to sell them through this medium and this is how I'm going to do it. And that's great.
Yep.
And as Mike Tyson says, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. And business is not, to my mind, anything like that. It's like life, that you think, okay, I'll try this, and you start on that route, and then you have to pivot and change. And I had both the challenge and the luxury of not having somebody else tell me, you're not allowed to turn the claims business into an insurance business. You're not allowed to flip that into that because that's not what we invested in.
Mm.
So if something didn't work, I had to fail very quickly and find something that did because I needed the income to come in.
Yeah.
And that made it a bit, rocky in that we would, you know, for years we'd have months where we'd have massive profitability and then nothing that, because it was... It was so. If you looked at the graph, it would have sent every possible investor
running
for the hills.
Yeah.
But it was still making a living for me and the family,
and
we were making it work. I've had a very different experience with my most recent business, Stella, which I launched in Australia because I got some investment in, and I understand it's a different game and it requires different skill sets and different. Philosophies, but I still think that there's merit to the other one. And I actually think women are particularly well placed for that kind of business building because they are able to juggle. They are able to find solutions. They are able to pivot.
Yeah. Yeah, I like it. I like it. Do you have to say it with an Australian? Stella, mate.
No, because then it sounds like Stella Artois, which definitely won't go with it because it's a brand for women.
Good point. The no options, you're back against the wall is definitely an important part to play. Do you think that, we've sort of talked about, let's label it your shit, right?
All the
stuff. Was there a time or a process you went away and travelled and decided to get on top of the fitness element, came back, still were being successful in business? Was there an evolution of you starting to get on top of your shit?
Yes, absolutely. And, I had panic attacks from my 20s to 30s, and obviously the weight problem and the smoking and the drinking was not going to be helping with that. Probably processing some of the stuff from childhood with my mum and the overdose. And then I realised that I was gay and started my first gay relationship at 30, which was also a big shift for me because obviously completely different lifestyle. But also, interestingly, I think the gay thing probably helps with the not drinking thing.
Okay.
Bear with me, because this is the dyslexic brain
in action.
The other
way around, I was thinking. from the gay environments I've been in and the world, it's like very synonymous with drinking.
It absolutely is. But if you use it in this way, and when you first come out, and certainly when I did, like I haven't had a negative response from people. Maybe one of the business guys I dealt with was a bit of an idiot, but generally speaking, people were great. No pushback. I don't have a coming out story that's filled with trauma. And I think partly because I didn't do it until I was older.
Yeah.
And I was very comfortable in my own skin. And I was like, my life, my choice, not your problem. Having said that, it's not a normal choice, just as not drinking is not a normal choice.
Okay.
And so it takes a certain type of personality that says, everybody else is doing that.
Yep.
I don't want to do that
totally.
Because this makes me happier.
Yep.
And so in that sense, the gay thing for me probably helped me make other choices that weren't necessarily
swimming with
the tide. What I have witnessed, however, and again, I think coming into it older, you take a different approach. I only did 1 year single gay after I got divorced from my, I say first wife. I'm not intending on having more than two. I think everybody's allowed one hiccup. but after I got divorced, I had 1 year single dating women, which I'd never done before, and with dating apps, which is a whole different podcast and like... Wow. But
I'm going to have to touch on it now.
But I, at that point, I think I witnessed the way that translates out to most young gay people, in that they're trying desperately to find a community, trying desperately to be settled in some regard, and alcohol and the clubs kind of gives them well, we know we can go to a gay club and be surrounded by other gay people that are all drinking. And there's not much in the way of sort of social groups where somebody who's single, who's also gay, can just naturally go out and engage with people.
Yeah.
And look, I don't think the problem's necessarily solved in the hetero community.
No.
We do, you know, a lot of dating is associated with alcohol.
Many, many podcasts could be done about the challenges of sober dating.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
Not that I've ever done it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, for the record, love you, wife.
But it's, you know, I do say when me and my wife go out, it's actually quite lovely. We often end up chatting to, like, we end up with like a group of young gay men all come over, and they love the fact that we're married and we've got kids, and, you know, we've got what would be deemed to be a heteronormative life.
Yeah, like a normal life.
But it shouldn't be excluded just because you choose to date the same sex. And actually, I think there's this idea that all that gay people want to do is go out and get drunk and get laid. And actually, they're, you know, just like anybody else.
Yeah, sure, in your 20s.
Yeah, exactly.
And some carry on till later, just as they do in the heterosexual world, carry on with all of that partying and everything else, exhausting.
Yeah, you need a lot of energy for that shit. Yeah.
But talking about a lot of energy, before I jump off on that, so let's go back a bit to when you started changing your relationship with alcohol. You came across 1 year no beer. How did that journey begin?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I'd always done like little detoxes, and I think that was just a sense check. And, you know, my view, I've never been arrogant enough to assume that I could never have a completely dysfunctional relationship with alcohol, regardless of the fact that that didn't happen. You know, I only have to look at my own stats, the age I started drinking, alcoholic mother, stress in the job, dyslexic. Mm. Like, you know, it's frankly a miracle that I didn't end up dysfunctional with the odds against me. So I always had sort of periods of time.
Saying you're not dysfunctional? I mean, not the alcohol.
The alcohol was all right, but yeah, dysfunctional in every other way. But, you know, I'd always do Dry January. I'd do like health retreats, juicing, that sort of stuff. Mm. Normally for probably a month, maybe 6 weeks. I did a much longer period of time when I was living in LA, which is interesting because it was a lot easier because the relationship that they have with alcohol over there is not the same as the UK. Trying to do that in the UK always seemed to trip me up. I'd get, you know, a run under my belt, and then it wouldn't work. And then I decided originally that I was going to do, like, raise some money for charity. I think I roped in a mate to say, look, should we do a no drinking thing? And then I came across 1 Year No Beer. And I loved it because it was the first time it was a positive message around not drinking. You know, as a lifestyle choice that was legitimate, that didn't mean that your life had fallen apart. Mm. And I work in the insurance industry, and they have a practical obsession with drinking, which is, you know, I'm not making judgments around it, but actually it becomes very difficult for you to kind of step out of it because the view is either you're an alcoholic or you're a normal drinker. And that just is not true. There's a whole range of steps in between that, you know, alcohol in of itself is a drug. And, you know, I've read all of the books, and we don't call people smokeaholics. We accept that if you use a drug, you're likely to get some form of addiction to it, you know. Mm. And you just can't have that conversation on a general basis. So what I loved about 1 Year No Beer was, actually, here's a group of people who are healthy, who, you know, look like they've got their shit together from a society viewpoint. They're just saying, actually, you know what, this thing, I don't want this thing to be as big a part of my life as it currently is.
Yeah.
And so I signed up, and I was like, okay, am I going to do this? And I found it really easy to do the year. like really easy. There was a couple of changes that I had to go through, but then it goes back to that neuroplasticity, put yourself in the situation. So I didn't not go out, which I think a lot of people do when they give up drinking. They stop doing the things that they always used to do.
Yep.
And I didn't stop doing anything. And I got to the end of the year and I actually thought, I don't really want to start again. Like, why would I do that? And then lockdown happened and I got kind of like everybody trapped in my house, staring at four walls, trying to make sense of what was going on in the universe. And everybody in my bubble drank and there was no kind of way out of the situation. So I decided to allow alcohol back in. But I think I was extremely conscious this time, and that's the gift that 1 year no beer gives, in that I knew that I could go out and not drink if I didn't want to. I knew what not drinking all the time felt like, and you know, that's the magic, isn't it? It's, you know, my sleep was incredible. I just naturally dropped half a stone a stone without having to do anything else. My fitness improved. I was reading much more. That was a surprising kind of side effect. So I knew all of those things were waiting for me if I wanted to go back to them. And I didn't, I was quite very moderate with it when I started drinking again. But I noticed over a period of time, it just creeps up. Like, it just is. It's like anything else, you know. And it got to a point where I was going out at the weekends and drinking too much, like not fall down drunk, throw up, but waking up in the morning not feeling great. And I just thought, what the hell am I doing? Like, what on earth am I doing this thing that actually adds no value whatsoever? And I think the sort of final click of the dial for me was, and I mentioned this to you before, I had it in my head that the one thing that alcohol gave me that I couldn't replace, you know, I could go out for dinner, non-alcoholic beer, fine, great, you know, socializing, as you can see, I'm not exactly shy, so that wasn't a problem. But it was this idea of having a wild adventure and being a bit naughty that was unexpected. Because if you switch off the rational side of your brain, there's a chance you're going to do something a little bit, you know, out of sync and, you know, not think it through. And that could be quite fun and exciting. And so the last bit for me was actually making sure that I could do that. Which I have done on numerous occasions. I mean, last week I ended up in a jazz bar, just on one of those nights where you meet up with one person and other people arrive, and you know, and everybody knows those nights when they drink, and they assume that they couldn't possibly do it when they don't. But I've made a concerted effort just to
go for it.
The only difference is, at a certain point when everybody's getting really incoherent, I will go home and get a good night's sleep and wake up and be able to do all of the stuff that I want to do with my life.
I love that. And one of the things here is the detaching of the math that we've done over decades, right? Alcohol equals fun, which, you know, from an early age, teens, and then into 20s, that's what the math is doing. Again and again and again and again, alcohol equals fun. And then people stop drinking or remove alcohol. They don't go out with their social circle. And alcohol equals boring. And they reiterate that, right? Well, you're going to go back to where it was because life's shit when you're alcohol-free and it's awesome when you're drinking. So this is what we have to teach people. Like, if you want to be able to control your drinking, you must create a Technicolor version of you that is alcohol free.
Yeah.
Right. So I can go out and have an amazing night or and not drink, or I can do it and drink. And when you've got that, you've got perfect choice.
Yeah.
So you can control it.
Yeah.
But one thing for me was I loved the craziness of like just going all in and, you know, properly binged, getting smashed up, having a laugh. Like I loved it at that end.
Yeah.
Loved the crazy places and all the madness that could happen. And so just when you said that earlier, now I resonated so much with that because I couldn't let that go. And I wouldn't want to, right? okay, I don't need alcohol to do that. But I had to prove that to myself. And so in the beginning, it was like, well, I'm going to go to the stag do. And basically, I'm going to make it my duty to have things, people to take, a couple of things people to say to me. One, I can't believe you're not drinking.
Yeah.
I want people to say that to me. I can't believe you're not drinking. And two, to just be like, to know they're like, good God, this guy's nuts, yeah, right? Yeah. And so that's how I had to behave like that for my own self, to feel that craziness. Sure, it gets much less and less requirement, but I really resonated with what you said there. So now you still do a bit of clubbing.
Absolutely, I like meeting new people. Like I say, I like having adventures. I like having crazy ass conversations with people, and I don't need alcohol to do that.
Yeah.
And actually, I was saying to my mate, and he was laughing at me. Like, I like being a bit cheeky, and I've got a dry sense of humour. I love that my wit is not dimmed by alcohol.
Yeah.
Because I can, you know.
It's even faster.
It's faster. Like, you know, I can be the smartest person in the room because everybody else is numbing themselves.
Still trying to catch up on the previous sentence.
Yeah, exactly. Amazing. And, you know, I went out last week. I've got membership at the Groucho Club, which is ace, and there's lots of really interesting people there. And I met up with a friend of mine who is an absolute wild child and gets involved in all sorts of stuff. And she was like, oh, I've got a few people coming down, and this guy turned up, and we ended up having a really in-depth conversation about life, the universe and everything. And then this music journalist joined us, and then somebody says, let's go to a club. And it's exactly the same as I have always had before. But what I realise now is I will not tolerate bad company and a bad evening, and I won't just drown it out with booze. Where before, you go to an event, you're not really having a great time.
Yeah.
The conversation isn't there, but I'll just get drunk and then I won't have to think about it. Like, now it's like, if that's the way that things are heading, I can bail and I can, you know, go home. The good will still be really good.
Yeah.
It's just that you will be cognizant of the bad.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know it's a bit Matrix, and sometimes, you know, I do think, should you just take the blue pill and enjoy the steak? But it's not, it isn't, it absolutely isn't, because having those experiences and being able to remember them with full clarity, and, as I say, waking up in the morning and feeling good.
Mm.
Like, my weekends are completely different now.
Yeah.
And it's nice. Oh, you know, I've had a few friends that have also, like, joined me in the not drinking.
Yeah.
Because they've seen...
You've inspired them.
Yeah.
In the lighthouse.
They're like, God, that's really working for you. And my best male mate and me, we go hiking every weekend, and we have such deep connected conversations.
Lovely. So much better.
It's so much better. Yeah. Like, our relationship has strengthened so much, where socially you tend to have the same, if you're drinking, you tend to have the same conversations over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And you don't mind because you've numbed your brain, and it's slightly less annoying.
Exactly. You're doing it yourself. The key element in there is both, right? You're still going out, you're still having fun.
Yeah.
You're still doing a part of that, which you need. You need that piece of you. And then, but also, you know, the weekends are more about rest now, and alcohol is, you know, destroys your rest, mm-hmm, and recovery, and so obviously the performance of that and things. But you mentioned about it getting a bit heavier in lockdown, and then to where we are today, which is your decision now moving forward. So just bring me up to speed there.
So that, I mean, you know, I didn't do 1 year no beer again because I'd already taught myself the lesson, and everything was kind of in play. But I'd just been thinking about it since we came out of lockdown. Again, you know, a few more spells. So I got married in August this year and wanted to lose some weight. Now, one of the things is true for me, I cannot lose weight and drink alcohol in any way, shape or form. Maybe some people can, and maybe they just don't eat anything and the booze kind of steps in. But for me, I can't train at the level that I need to train at to lose weight. You know, female hormones, 47, things won't necessarily, you're going to have a slightly harder time of it to shift weight, and alcohol just that sends me over the edge. So I wanted to lose some weight for the wedding, and, you know, I always just give up booze as one of the things. And I did that, and again, felt great. And then drank August, September, came into October, and just, I know I'll never drink again, which is, you know, I totally respect people that dip in and out. I've dipped in and out myself for a number of years. I respect people that want to drink socially. It's, you know, it's all about choices and what works for you and what doesn't. But for me, I'm now at that place with alcohol that I was at with cigarettes, which is I see zero benefit. Upside. There is no upside to it that I can possibly justify to myself. And so I'm done.
Yeah.
Which is great. It feels great.
So easy.
Yeah.
it's an amazing place because, it's so clarifying. You're like, is it alcohol? Yes. Okay, well then, no, I'm not drinking it.
Yeah.
Whereas maybe and could and everything else.
That's tiring, right?
Yeah, but like, well, it's also a completely different area of the brain. The decision is 1,000 times more complicated for the brain, even though it doesn't very quickly, because it involves different areas, memory, processing, all of those things. Whereas yes, no is just
dead easy.
Binary.
Dead easy.
Amazing. And so cleared out of that, what... We mentioned before, you post occasionally on LinkedIn about you not drinking or changing your relationship with alcohol, and you get a lot of direct messages, usually from people in the insurance industry. And this is a conversation I've been having on this podcast, is that that's the only space for most of society, either quietly at the bar to have a conversation with you when they find you out you're not drinking, or to reach out to you on social media or having a quiet conversation with you. And so what do you normally say to somebody? What's your advice to someone? What would you say to somebody who's reached out to you thinking about changing their relationship?
You know what? It's really lovely. I had one of your guys from One Year No Beer on my podcast a couple of years ago, and actually somebody reached out to me that gave up completely after listening to the podcast. And I had no idea. And he didn't reach out to me until a year afterwards. And he just said, thank you. You changed my life. I listened to the podcast and this is what happened, which was, for me, was absolutely magic.
Huge, yeah.
I think, you know, and also a little bit recognising what happened for my mum and not wanting any other kids to go through that. Because it's a terrible waste of a childhood, and it's a terrible waste of a person's life. But I think when people question me about it, I always talk about being, which is obviously a bit cheeky, having come out when I was 30, but I talk about being dry curious. And I think a lot more people are dry curious now than they ever used to be. And I think the stigma of the dysfunctional, down and out alcoholic that's been told they're on the naughty step and they can no longer drink again is starting to be dispelled. And for me, it's really important to be visible. There needs to be more of us that are visible, because most are so worried about societal judgment. And I still feel a little bit of that. You know, I'm still clear to say it never got to that point, because you don't want people to see you as weak, or, you know, which obviously it's not. But there's a fear in there around this whole subject. And for me, I just want it to be as acceptable as a life choice as any other health choice that you would
make. Like,
when I used to say, oh, I'm on a diet, I'm trying to lose a few pounds, people would do the requisite nice thing of, oh, you really don't need to. But they wouldn't be like, no, don't be boring, have a cake.
Yeah.
Like,
just one
cake, one fruit pastel won't kill you. Like, you know, for me, being able to kind of say to people, this feels amazing.
Yeah.
Like, amazing.
Yeah.
I am accomplishing more than I have ever accomplished. I feel better in myself. You know, I've moved into the dream house from my brain's perspective. Oh. And I'm loving the spa and the the gym.
Jacuzzi,
and
the garden, the sauna, the hyperbaric chamber.
Yeah. Well, no, easy. Yeah.
What was the It's gone. Cold therapy.
Cryotherapy.
Thank you.
Yes, yeah, I love a bit of cryotherapy. But yeah, I think I would love more people to have this. And I think there is a whole chunk of people who, whilst not what society would deem to be alcoholics or dysfunctional, are, as you would describe, grey area drinkers that are not happy in of themselves with the relationship that they've got with alcohol. And they should feel comfortable to be able to explore that and have conversations with people about what it looks like not to choose to drink.
Exactly. We came up with a little campaign, which we never launched. But it was sort of like the ice bucket challenge. I wonder how many people have thought about that. But along this whole break the beer pressure, and really to try and get a campaign out there to be like, look, if somebody says they're not drinking, just leave them alone. And this is, you know, if we all say, look, drop the pressure.
Yeah,
you know, just
absolutely.
Make it acceptable for somebody. But I think society's heading that way. It's definitely getting more accepted. It's definitely getting more.
I hear
from people all the time that are like, oh, you know, actually one of the guys posted in the community today just saying, you know, he tells people that he's doing a leadership development program and part of it is not drinking, and that's the end of the story. I think it's about how you present the story.
For sure. And the confidence.
It also depends where you live.
Yes.
Because it doesn't matter how many times I went to the Bellacroix on the Isle of Mull and Derwick and told them I was doing a leadership development program, there'd still be a pint coming across. Shut up and drink that.
Yeah, absolutely. There is definitely different degrees of. And it's also, I like people and I like to make people feel comfortable. And one of the hardest things for me is I know that me not drinking makes some people very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And whilst I don't want them to feel any kind of way because I'm genuinely a judgment-free zone, I also don't want to. It's about personal kind of boundaries and self-care.
Mm.
I'm not going to drink just so that you don't feel terrible about drinking.
Yeah, like, exactly.
That's not going to work. Just like I'm not going to start smoking just because, or start vaping because people vape. It's, you know, it, my choice doesn't have to be your choice.
Yeah.
But we have to stop this bleed into those individual choices being such an area of societal pressure, for sure.
Completely. Do you think business can do more?
Oh my God, yes. Oh my God, yes. Like, so, you know, being in business is tough. Like, there's a lot of challenges on you emotionally, mentally, and not being at your physical best is going to make that a lot bloody harder.
Mm.
I want to see representations of CEOs as being the elite athletes that they need to be.
Yeah.
Not
leading by example.
Not, you know, overweight, drunk, you know, going down roads that they shouldn't be going down. Because I know damn well, like, I used to drink only at the weekends because there's no way I could cope with the week without it. But still, Monday, Tuesday, I'd be a lot dustier than I was.
Yeah.
Now I've got none of that downtime. I'm like super, super productive.
Yeah.
And I want my kids to see that. So I'm aware how much the subtle messaging affected me as a child because all my parents really did socially was drink and smoke. We never went out for walks. We didn't exercise. And as a kid, that's what being grown up looks like. Like, oh, the magic of being able to have a drink. So I will say to my kids, I don't drink because it's poison. It makes you feel sick.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, why would people do it? I don't know. Like, you know, I want them to see that. And I want, you know, I want kids to see positive role models in business that are making choices that give them a good life and not a life that is filled with regret or, you know, on comfortability.
Totally. And I mean, role model is one way. I think a lot of companies, you know, we touch on this because, like, when you post, lots of people reach out to you. And I had Dan yesterday, who's a VC, last week or whatever, on the podcast, who's a VC. And, you know, we were talking very much about this, about the fact that nobody would come up to him and talk to him about how to raise or how to find out, you know, they wouldn't sideline him for that conversation that he was expecting. They'd sideline him and say, what about this not drinking?
Yeah.
And it was the one conversation that everybody wanted to have. I think business is not having the conversation in the right way.
Agreed.
I think that there is a lot of employee assistance programs that have massive underutilization. It's like under 1% on average for employees to actually want to call up and get support. And that the real part is that, okay, yeah, if you've got a very serious problem and fall off the edge, then we have something for you, but not really having the conversation. And I think the employees feel like they can't have the conversation. Similarly, I've spoke to a guy and he said, no, I can't have anything about alcohol to do with me at all. It's actually written into my contract that if I have any issue with alcohol, I'll be immediately terminated.
Which, and then this whole concept of an issue. We come back to, you're a normal drinker. So you're not allowed to question your relationship with it at any point unless your entire life implodes. Yeah. And then at that point, you're screwed.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any logical sense to me. Like, I know I've got people that work for me that are drinking too much and that it'll be affecting their performance and their home life and, you know, and everything else.
Mm.
And, you know, I hope that by having such public conversations about it, they will feel comfortable. Just like I'd talk about the fact that I happen to be gay or northern, you know.
Well, that is an affliction.
Yeah, that is a problem. Yeah. You know, I think it's really important to kind of be comfortable having the conversation so that they're comfortable having those conversations.
Yeah.
And then you can talk about, you know, what can we all do as a group? Because the other thing is, generally speaking, everybody's going to benefit from cutting down.
Mm.
I mean, in the insurance industry, I would say 80% probably drink more than they wish to.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if John's drinking 20 pints a week and Simon's drinking 8 pints a week and Mary's drinking a bottle of wine, if all of them are doing something where that alcohol's being taken out and they're improving their performance and they're doing it as a group.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel quite so isolating. And, you know, whoever I said at the top that's doing the 20 pints, it might get the most benefit out of it.
Yeah.
But it's still something that everybody can connect with and everybody can get an upside from.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that in part, and then also, obviously making people aware of 1 year no beer is a good thing to do.
Yes.
or other things like that. And making sure that there's lots of alcohol free alternatives and making it a more inclusive space whenever there's events on and all of those things that certainly can be improvement. Are you an advocate of the alcohol free drinks? Do you use those?
Yeah, I do. So, I love things like, Lucky Saint, and I've tried pretty much every one of the non-alcoholic beers. I did rather worryingly find the non-alcoholic Baileys at Christmas and then saw how many calories were in it. But it tastes amazing.
Non-alcoholic. Has it got the spite, the twang?
It's
really
got, it tastes better.
Is it actually Baileys or is it a
it's
fake
Irish
mix?
Cream. So,
oh, really?
But it is.
What's it called?
I'll send you. It's, you can get it on Amazon. They do all of them. They do mojitos, Baileys. I've given it to drinking friends and non-drinking friends.
Yep.
Everyone fell in love with it.
Mm.
It literally tastes even better than Baileys.
Wow.
But it's 400 calories a can. So, and it turns out
that's a meal. That's a bottle of fuel.
It is. It turns out that Baileys has got a lot of calories in it as well, which I obviously wasn't aware when I was drinking. But, you know, if you do it like it's a Baileys, so you put lots of ice in the glass and like a third.
It's only a 50 mil, not a full can and stuff. That's the problem with the alcohol-free drinks is that you don't seem to have the same monitor. I find that if I have a gin, alcohol-free gin and tonic, it's gone like it would be lemonade versus yes. it being yeah, a gin
yeah.
and tonic.
Yeah, for sure. Although I do find, like, I never used to really drink beer. I was a wine drinker. I have to say the non-alcoholic wine's terrible, so I've given up the ghost on that. I haven't, you know, I've tried loads of them. They're all bad.
Okay.
The non-alcoholic lager, like Lucky Saint, Erdinger, really, really good.
Yeah.
But I didn't drink beer before. And now I just find, like, I'll have a couple. Like, you don't, because it's not got the drug in it,
yeah.
you're not going to
no.
just keep...
Keep going.
But I think they're a great tool just for a little bit of social cohesion.
Yeah.
I find people think I'm drinking because I'm holding a bottle of beer and, you know, that's fine. It yeah. saves the conversation.
Exactly. It reduces down the peer pressure and all of that kind of stuff. Amazing. Okay, any final thoughts on changing your relationship with alcohol for anyone out there thinking about doing it?
Just give it a go and don't think of it as a punishment. Think of it as an absolute amazing gift.
Mm.
I think the biggest thing about this is changing the perception from something that you are giving up and therefore, you know, a deprivation into something that you are getting. Because, you know, particularly over the age of 40, you want everything that makes you feel a bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I feel absolutely fantastic. And I know one of the key components is the fact that I don't poison myself every weekend anymore.
Yeah. Awesome. Sam, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the 1 Year No Beer podcast, where our mission is to share and tell the stories of the everyday heroes who are taking the steps to make a meaningful impact by changing their relationship with alcohol. If you want to join our community and find out more about the variety of benefits that you can enjoy by becoming part of our 80,000 plus members within our alcohol-free movement, then click the link in the show notes below.